All right, so I have the, I don't know if it's enviable or unenviable task of studying Divrei HaYamim with you today. On the one hand, it's a very exciting day because Divrei HaYamim represents the final book of Tanakh, the last of the 24 books of our Hebrew Bible, which makes today a very momentous day. How many people here made every class? Wow. Very impressive. Or listen to every class. If you didn't make it, you got the CD. You could still get. You should be able to get all of them in the shul office, but it's very momentous. That puts you, if you've made it every single class, that puts you in a very, 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 very small percentage of people who've actually covered all the major themes, people, places, episodes of Tanakh. The average Jew, the average non-Jew, has heard of the Bible, but is not familiar at all with the stories of the Bible, the Tanakh. So if you've made it through Kol HaKavod, congratulations, Mazal Tov, it's a tremendous milestone. It's really a major, major, major achievement. So the good news is that today represents the final book. It's a very exciting day, it's a momentous day. It represents the concept of a siyum. I'll tell you the truth, what we should do is begin Bereishis all over again, because the Jewish concept of learning is that at a siyum, you don't only complete a portion of study, but you begin the next portion. And so doing, we make the statement that one is never done studying. The temptation is to feel, okay, I read the book, closed, done, put it on the shelf, next book. But in Judaism, the idea is that there's so many multiple layers and levels of understanding that even if one has completed it on a superficial level or an initial level, there's so many deeper levels, you're never done studying. In fact, Rabbi Soloveitchik suggested that's why the end of davening, on Shabbos morning, what's the very last thing we do at the end of davening? What do we sing? Adon Olam. Why do we sing Adon Olam? Is it a coincidence that we begin davening with Adon Olam and end davening with Adon Olam? Rabbi Soloveitchik suggested that we are ending davening by beginning again. We're making the statement that just because shul is over, one should never feel I'm done davening. Check, prayer, done, talk to God, finished. But rather it's a cycle. We're never done, we begin again. So as much as today is a siyum, and it's a celebration, and we're completing something very, very momentous, but it really is also just the beginning. So that's the good news. The bad news is, Divrei HaYamim is a really tough book. It's a tough book to learn. It's a tough book to teach. So we're going to do our best here. But Divrei HaYamim is arguably the most neglected book in Tanakh. It's perhaps and probably the most neglected book in Tanakh. Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel are not so beloved. They're very difficult books to understand, but they comprise a lot of Haftorahs, and people study them and their connection to the Churban, to the destruction of the temple. Divrei HaYamim, which ends all of Tanakh, is very, very difficult to study. So what I want to look at today is not so much as dissecting so many of the psukim, the verses, though we will look at some, but really talking about what is the overarching theme. What is Divrei HaYamim about? Right, because we didn't go through any of the verses, in a sense. Today you're completing Tanakh, and hopefully, if I say the name of a book, you could tell me more or less the time period in which it occurred, maybe who wrote it, what were the major themes or episodes in it. We didn't get to the verses themselves. But each book clearly seeks to communicate something. Some of the books seek to communicate history. If you look at Yoshua, the book of Joshua, it's telling us the history of the conquest of the land. 7 years they conquered the land, 7 years they divided the land, and the period of when Yoshua leads them over the Jordan River into the land of Israel, and when they are conquering the Canaanite nations. The book of Shoftim clearly is communicating this period of the judges, which was, by the way, dominated by calm and tranquility, but one wouldn't get that impression, because Shoftim is written in such a way that that wants to communicate the periods of struggle so that we can learn from them. When we abandon God's ways, when we're influenced by our surroundings and we forget our values, what can happen? Each book has a theme, each book has a message. And the question I want to examine with you today is, what is the message, what is the theme of Divrei HaYamim? Now this is particularly difficult, because I'll give you an example. Open up to the beginning of Divrei HaYamim. Divrei HaYamim 1, Divrei HaYamim Aleph, chapter 1, and look at that opening chapter. It is miserable. It doesn't read. Adam, Seth, Enosh, Canaan, Mahalal, Jared, Enoch, Mizut. It's a list of names. It's like a census. It's like the shul list. Opening Divrei HaYamim is like reading the phone book. What's going on? It's the first chapter, it's the second chapter, it's the third chapter, and you go on and on and on. Now we do have periods of narrative, we'll get to that in a moment, but when you begin to read Divrei HaYamim, it literally reads like a phone book. It's difficult to study, and it's even more difficult to understand, what are we doing? What is its goal? What is it seeking to accomplish? Now it begins with genealogy. Adam, Shes, Enosh, and so on. It begins with Adam. Adam's son, who was Shes. Enosh, whose son was Kenan, and so on and so forth. It's a genealogy, it's a family tree. That's how the book begins. How does the book end? Go right to the end of the book. Divrei Hayam and Beis, talk about in a moment, are there really two volumes or is it one? But go right to the end of Divrei Hayam and 2, it's chapter 36, look at verse 22. And this is how all of Tanakh ends. In the first year of Cyrus, Koresh, who was the king of Persia, upon the expiration of Hashem's prophecy spoken by Yirmiyahu, God aroused the spirit of Koresh, king of Persia, and he issued a proclamation through his kingdom and in writing as well. What happened? We've covered all of history, from the beginning of the world, from creation, from Adam, from Adam, and we talked all about the beginning of the Jewish people, and I'll show you in a moment, and we cover all the way through the period of the reign of King Shaul, the reign of King David, of David HaMelech, of King David, his son Shlomo, Solomon. We covered all the way through the split of the kingdoms, the northern, the southern kingdom, Rechavam, Yeravam, the dispersion of the 10 tribes, the 10 lost tribes of Israel, the destruction of the first temple and its exile, and that brings us to the end of Tanakh. Chronologically, in terms of dating, Tanakh ends with Koresh. Who is Koresh? Koresh is the king of Persia. He lives in the 6th century BCE. And he is the one who God gave. He made this proclamation. Verse 23, the very end, the last verse of all of Tanakh. Thus said Koresh, king of Persia, Hashem, God of heaven, has given to me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has commanded me to build the temple in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever there is among you of his entire people, may Hashem, his God, be with him, and let him go up. V'ya'al. Go up. All of Tanakh ends with the proclamation from Koresh that after the first exile, the first destruction of the first temple, Koresh announces the time for rebuilding has come. I am going to rebuild God's temple. The Jewish people are invited. They are welcome back from their exile in Babylonia. 70 years have passed since the destruction of the first temple. It's time to come back. It's time to come home. And indeed, that's what happens. Under him, we have the return to Israel, and we have the creation, the building of the second temple. So the book of Divrei Hayamim covers from creation, Adam, the beginning of the world, all the way through the end of Tanakh. And this is, that correlates with Ezra and Nehemiah, which you studied recently, the return of after the first exile, when they're going to repopulate Jerusalem and Israel, and they're going to build the second temple. So in terms of the dating of Tanakh, that's the end of Tanakh. So Divrei Hayamim seems to be a synopsis. It's a summary, it's a historical summary, a chronological summary of Tanakh. How did Tanakh begin? With the book of Bereishis. And how did the book of Bereishis begin? With the creation of man. So we go from the creation of the world, the creation of man, which is the first word of Divrei Hayamim, Adam, man, Adam, and it takes you all the way to the last story of all of Tanakh, which was when Koresh invited the Jewish people to return to Israel. So it begs the question, are we dedicating the 24th and final book of Tanakh as essentially a summary of the first 23? Is it a review of all of Tanakh until now? Is there something more to it? What's going on? What's going on in this book? And it's even more puzzling, by the way, because as much as it reads like a phone book and a family tree and genealogical lines, and there's a list of names and places and people and kings, there are major, major events which, if I were summarizing Jewish history, I would have included, and the book of Divrei Hayamim doesn't. For example, Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah. Har Sinai. The Sinai experience, the giving of the Torah, is not included in Divrei Hayamim. Jewish people entering the land, the notion of the conquest, is not included in the review. So there are major episodes that are simply omitted, that are not here. There's the entire northern kingdom, right? Just to remind you, because you've all seen this recently, so hopefully you know it better than I do. But to remind you, you have the first king of Israel is Shaul, Saul, anointed by Shmuel, by the prophet Samuel. Shaul fails God, doesn't meet his expectation. What does he do wrong particularly, specifically? He does not destroy the people of Amalek when commanded to do so. He allows a remnant of the people to remain, and that has continued to haunt us until today. a descendant of Amalek is none other than Ahmadinejad, Iran. Amalek, Shaul's failure continues to haunt us literally until today. God tells Shmuel, tragically, sadly, Shaul's not my man. He cannot continue a dynasty. He's out. Time for the next king. And we had the whole episode. Shmuel goes to Yishai. You have lots of sons. Which one is going to be the king? He brings them all out. He says, I've exhausted the list. He says, it can't be. None of them are it. He brings out a final son. It's none other than King David. None other than David who's going to be the king. By the way, why did he think David couldn't be the king? And David spends his kingdom, his royalty, defending his legitimacy to the throne. Why would anyone question his legitimacy to the throne? Who does David descend from? From Moab, from Rus. His great-great-grandmother is Rus. She's from the tribe of Moab. What's the problem of being from the tribe of Moab? Well, because when the Jewish people were traveling to Israel, Moab did not let us pass through their land and did not give us provisions and expressed a sense of cruelty, we said we could never afford to absorb that character of cruelty and insensitivity into our people, forbidden to marry the tribe of Moab. Even if they convert to Judaism, it's not an intermarriage issue. We're forbidden to marry someone from the tribe of Moab. So King David descends from Moab, Rus HaMoaviyah, and therefore there are questions. How could King David be the king? But of course, we end up concluding it's Moavi v'lo Moaviyah. A male person from the tribe of Moab can't enter the Jewish people, but a female descendant of Moab can. So therefore, an offspring of Rus qualifies. So King David is chosen, he is the king. King David reigns, he's beloved by the people, he leaves his son King Shlomo, Solomon, who ultimately builds the temple, has many wives, is the wisest of all men, and although those two things you have to reconcile how they go together, but the Shlomo HaMelech makes a strategic error, a terrible mistake. His father taxed the people. King Shlomo dies, and he leaves whom to take over the reign? His son Rehavam. Rehavam decides, well, my dad levied great taxes and nobody complained. I'm going to increase the taxes, maintain the taxes on the people. The people rebel. What was his mistake? Why did his father levy the taxes against the people? What were those monies used for? Building the temple, building the Beis HaMikdash. Rehavam made that mistake. And what happens is a rebellion. Yeravam splits off, takes 10 tribes with him, heads north, and they become a northern kingdom, independent. So you have the kingdom of Yisrael, of the 10 tribes to the north, the kingdom of Yehuda, of Judah, who is the Davidic dynasty, Shlomo, Rehavam, to the south, and you have terrible conflict, civil war taking place between the two. Yeravam to the north, the northern kingdom, establishes their own idols, say, why do you need to go to that temple to serve? You could still serve up here. Why travel so far? And so on and so forth. So you have a northern kingdom that has a whole history. Does it appear in the book of Divrei Hayamim, the northern kingdom? No. Almost as if they don't exist. They are mentioned, the northern kingdom, only in the context of the destiny of the southern kingdom and some of the fights that took place between the two. But to mention the northern kingdom independently as a kingdom and its leaders, omitted from Divrei Hayamim. Doesn't exist. Why? No Har Sinai, no conquest of the land, no northern kingdom. So many major omissions from Divrei Hayamim. So if the purpose was to be a summary of everything that occurred in Tanakh from the beginning of Bereishis until the end, then why omit these major people, personalities, places, and events? So that is essentially the question we're going to look at today. What is Divrei Hayamim about? What is it trying to communicate? What is the book all about? Okay. So okay, the book has 65 chapters in all, over 1,500 psukim verses. Now we, in our tradition, the Jewish tradition, there is one book of Divrei Hayamim, one book of Chronicles. The Christian tradition divided it into two books, and their editors did, and it ended up making its way into even our Tanakh as two books. In the count of Tanakh, it's really one. In fact, you have this in two other places in Tanakh, as you just studied and experienced. Where else do we have this? With Shmuel and with Malachim. We have Shmuel, Aleph, and Beis. Really, in our tradition, there's one book of Samuel, though the editors divided it into two. But in our tradition, there's one book of Malachim, one book of Kings, though the editor is divided into two. And similarly, there's really one book of Divrei Hayamim, though the editor were the ones who divided it into two. And that division made its way into the Hebrew Bible by printers in the 15th century and has stuck since then. But even today, we refer to Divrei Hayamim Aleph and Divrei Hayamim Beis, Samuel 1, Samuel 2, Kings 1, Kings 2. But really, in our tradition, it's all one book. It's one volume, Kings, Samuel, Chronicles. Okay, yes. When did it say? 15th century. Okay, the Gemara in Baba Basra, the Talmud in Baba Basra, which if you recall, 14b, has been listing the attributions of who authored which books of Tanakh. The Talmud identifies, first of all, identifies Divrei Hayamim as the final book of the Ketubim, of the Ksuvim, of the third of the areas of the Bible, and attributes the author of Divrei Hayamim to Ezra. Now you studied Ezra, Ezra Nehemiah. Ezra was the great leader who took the Jewish people from the exile of Babylonia, led this return to Israel. Of course, the overwhelming majority did not return. They remained. This is something that has plagued our people. We're about to experience Pesach. What percent of the people left Egypt, of the Jewish people? 20%. 80% of the Jewish people remained in Egypt. God gave a green light. God performed open and revealed miracles. God revealed His hand and said, "You are my people, a people of destiny. Follow me." How many followed Him? 20%. Ezra says, Koresh has invited, we're allowed to return. It's the return. The exile is over. Miracles occurred. We're going back to Jerusalem. Knew who's coming with me. How many returned? Very few. Very few. I don't know the percentage. Who taught you Ezra? Hopefully they taught you that. And 1948, God says again to us, "I've performed open miracles. The land of Israel is now the state of Israel, Jewish sovereignty after 2,000 years. Who's coming with me?" says Rabbi Fass, Nefesh B'Nefesh. And here we are sitting in Boca Raton. Sadly, it's a terrible embarrassment and shame for all of us. But hopefully every single one of us is planning our aliyah, planning when we can move to Israel as we speak. So Ezra leads the return. The Gemara in Baba Basra says that Ezra is the one who wrote the book of Divrei Hayamim. Now that poses a problem. It poses a problem because we have Zerubbabel's descendants. Anyone know who Zerubbabel was? Zerubbabel was one of the generals, one of the leaders of the Jewish people who led the return. And Zerubbabel, the text lists six generations after Zerubbabel, which gets us to the year 350 BCE. And if it lists six generations after Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel lived as a contemporary of whom? Ezra. Well, how could somebody write a book that chronicles six generations later? They ostensibly did not live to see the next six generations. So it's difficult to assume that Ezra was really the author. In fact, the Maharshal, Reb Shlomo Luria, one of the commentaries on the Talmud, has a different view. He says that, no, the Gemara doesn't mean to imply that Ezra is the author of Divrei Hayamim, but what it meant to say is the genealogy listed in Divrei Hayamim is evidence for Ezra's own genealogy and proving that he is a worthy leader and that he descends from worthwhile Yichus. Okay, but that's who the Gemara attributes as the author. Very few commentaries. Limited commentary on Divrei Hayamim. One of the most prolific authors of all time in Jewish scholarship is none other than Rashi. Rav Shlomo Rashi stands for, it's an acronym, Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki. Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki. His name was Shlomo Rashi. He lived in France. He maintained a vineyard. He had only daughters. Daughters married very brilliant scholars. His grandsons were great scholars. They became ultimately the Balei Tosfos. They were the progenitors of Ashkenazi Jewry. Rashi writes on almost all of Tanakh. Rashi writes a commentary on all of Mishnah. Rashi writes a commentary on almost all of Talmud. Rashi is a prolific writer, and as Rabbi Beryl Wein describes so brilliantly, one is in awe of Rashi when you think that if you took a quill and ink and all you did was copy Rashi's commentary without giving it any thought, if all you did was copy it, it would take a lifetime to copy. The fact that he, while maintaining a vineyard, while running from the Crusades, was able to have the creativity to also author a commentary which opens up all of Talmud for us, Rashi's incredible greatness. The other brilliance of Rashi is described is, you know what Rashi's greatness was? he was able to study Gemara without Rashi. Now, we couldn't begin to study Gemara, Talmud, without the commentary of Rashi. All of our understanding relies on Rashi. He opens it up for us. Rashi's greatness was he studied Gemara without Rashi. So while Rashi was this prolific author, wrote on everything, no Rashi on Divrei HaYamim. Rashi took a break for Divrei HaYamim. There's very, very little commentary. The first major commentator to write on this book was Rav David Kimchi. Rav David Kimchi, an acronym for his name is Radak. Rav David Kimchi. Kimchi means flour. Professionally, he probably had something to do with grinding flour. But Rav David Kimchi, the Radak, writes on it. The Yabar Benel admits in his introduction to the book of Shmuel that he had never studied Divrei HaYamim until, which we'll see, there's a lot of overlap between the book of Malachim, of Kings, and Shmuel, and Divrei HaYamim. Since so much of Divrei HaYamim is comprised of retelling of the kingship of King David and Shlomo HaMelech, that's all in Shmuel and Malachim. So there's a lot of overlap. So the Bar Benel says, confesses, I never opened and studied Divrei HaYamim. It was only when studying Shmuel and Malachim, Samuel and Kings, and I wanted to contrast it with the way the events were recorded in Divrei HaYamim, that's when I first opened it. So you see, it's a very neglected book. It's a very difficult book. It reads like a phone book. It's a summary of all of Tanakh, and yet it omits major factors. What is going on with this book? Yes?
Just a slight question.
Sure.
Is Rashi more prolific than Maimonides?
Very different. In the sense that, first of all, Rashi preceded him. But in the sense that Rashi writes commentary, the Rambam Maimonides records law. Rashi runs a... We don't have response of Rashi. Rashi has a running commentary on the Bible, on Tanakh, on Mishnah, on Talmud, and so on. But we don't rely on Rashi for his understanding or interpretation of law. The Rabbi Maimonides saw the entire Talmud and wanted to organize it and codify it, and did so brilliantly. And by the way, when you think about, it's unimaginable what they accomplished. And here we are, in the most comfortable time ever, with technological advancement ever, and we say we don't even have time to read a book. Right? The Rambam was an accomplished physician, the physician of the Sultan of Egypt. The Rambam, Maimonides himself, had to flee for his life from Spain. In fact, there are scholars who argue he was forced to convert to Islam, but Muslims who persecuted Maimonides and his family, he was expelled from Spain, was on the run, Egypt, ultimately comes to Israel. So the man is an accomplished physician who is obligated to the Sultan. He is on the run, fleeing for his life, and yet he takes the entire Talmud, which takes a lifetime to study, and organizes it into an incredible encyclopedia that we, with the benefit of technology and word processors, would still struggle to organize it as well as he did. So they really had different motifs. Rashi was a commentator, and Maimonides was a codifier, seeking to codify law.
Maimonides is reported to have read and absorbed every analysis of every rabbi at the time so that he can condense them.
Yeah, well, he writes in his introduction, we'll get back to Divrei HaYamim in a second, he writes in his introduction, his code of Jewish law is called Yad HaChazaka. We call it Yad HaChazaka. Yad HaChazaka means the strong hand, which God is described when he takes the Jewish people out of Egypt as having a strong hand. Yad, Yud Dalet, is the number, numerical value 14. Because Maimonides' code has 14 volumes to it. He divides Jewish law into 14 different areas. Yad HaChazaka. But that's not the name that Maimonides himself gave it. The name Maimonides himself gave it was Mishneh Torah. Mishneh Torah. In his introduction, he calls it the Mishneh Torah. What does Mishneh Torah mean? It means the summary or the repetition of Torah. And he writes in his introduction that you no longer need to have a vast Jewish library filled with volumes of Babylonian Talmud, Jerusalem Talmud, commentators, this, that, and the other. He says, all you need now in your library are a Tanakh and my code of Jewish law. Because I've summarized and I've organized everything from before him, from the Talmud, into his 14 different books of Jewish law. We find that to be a little bit presumptuous, that name, Mishnah Torah, so we prefer to call it the Yad HaChazakah. So the Rambam and Rashi write differently. So Rashi doesn't write on Divrei HaYamim. The Radak is the first major commentator. The Abarbanel himself confesses that he didn't really study Divrei HaYamim independently, only he ended up studying it to be able to better understand the books of Samuel and Kings. So what's really going on here? What's really going on here? So let's start from the beginning. If you have your Tanakh, if you have the Bible. So you have the genealogy, it begins from the beginning. We said, Adam, Adam. God creates Adam. And then his son, Shes, and Enosh, and Canaan, and so on and so forth. And we have just a list of names. We have a list of names that go down. Who does the list of names get to? Avram, verse 28. The sons of Abraham of Avram are Yitzchak and Yishmael. And these are their generations. And then it gets to Yitzchak. Avram begat Yitzchak. The sons of Yitzchak are Esav and, interestingly identifies Esav and Yisrael. B'nei Yitzchak, Esav v'Yisrael. Not Yaakov, but goes right to his new name, Yisrael. The sons of Esav are fine. Then it keeps going. Edom's early kings. And then all we go next, chapter 2. How does chapter 2 begin? The genealogy of Yehuda. Once we've gone from Avram, Avram had Yitzchak and Yaakov. I'm sorry, Avram had Yitzchak and Yishmael. We don't really care about Yishmael. We continue with Yitzchak. Yitzchak has Yaakov and Esav. We don't really care about Esav. We continue with Yaakov. Yaakov gives birth to how many children? Yaakov has 12 sons. I shouldn't say, and a daughter. At least one daughter, Dinah. Yaakov has 12 sons. And who is the first of those sons?
Reuben.
So what would I expect chapter 2 to begin with? Now that I'm continuing with Yaakov and his line, it should have Reuven, Shimon, Levi, and so on. Who does it start with?
Yehuda.
Judah. These were the sons of Israel. And it's now going to give the entire genealogy of Yehuda. And it continues all the way down with the genealogy of Yehuda, all the way down through King David. And that's chapter 3. Now, because King David, of course, descends from the tribe of Yehuda. Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda. The staff shall never pass from Yehuda. God promised Yaakov on his deathbed when he gave blessings to his 12 sons, blessed his son Yehuda, Judah, that royalty, monarchy would descend from him. Shaul was a deviation from that. And then of course King David and Solomon is the continuation of that. And that's why our tradition is that Moshiach, the Messiah, who will be a king, will be Moshiach ben, the son of
David,
King David. He's going to descend from David. So now we have King David's children all listed. King David's royal line. Chapter 4 begins, other descendants of Judah. So you're sitting here saying to yourself, one second, what happened here? Avraham has Yitzchak and Yishmael, we don't care about Yishmael, fine. Yitzchak has Esav and Yaakov, we don't care about Esav, fine. Yaakov. Yaakov has 12 sons, we care about them all. They all become the Jewish people. So we'd expect to have the genealogy of Reuben, the genealogy of Shimon, the genealogy of Levi. Instead, we spend a few chapters on the genealogy of Yehuda, traced all the way down to King David. And only then, in verse 24, do we get to the genealogy of the other tribes. Only now do we go backwards. And that's chapter 5. Reuben, Vene Reuven, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, the children of Hath-Menasseh. And then we get to chapter 6. Now the Levite families. The Levite families, of course, could send from the tribe of Levi. The tribe of Levi, I think we talked about this, I don't remember if it was this class, the tribe of Levi, Kohanim and Levi both come from the same tribe, the priests and the Levites. They come from the tribe of Levi, because Moshe and Aaron were both from the same tribe. Moshe became the first Levi, and Aaron became the first priest, the first Kohen. So here we have the Levite families, the temple singers, the cities that were given to the Levium. And now we return to the other tribes. Chapter 7. Yisachar, Binyamin, Naphtali, the other half of Manasseh, Ephraim, Asher. And now we're going to, in chapter 8, get to the story of the first king of Shaul. If you look at now, let's go to the outline, just on page 2 of your handout. On the top you have a grid that shows you the outline of Divrei HaYamim. We just went through book 1, chapters 1 through 9. They are the genealogical tables. Not in the order we would have anticipated. First, complete emphasis on the tribe of Yehuda, of Judah, all the way tracked down through King David, only then returning to the other tribes. Now, chapter 10 is the reign of Shaul. Shaul gets a whopping one chapter. He gets a whopping one chapter. Chapter 10 is the story of Shaul. And what I mentioned to you earlier, which appears in the book of Samuel, how Shaul fails God. That's chapter 10. You see it? The death of King Saul. the Plishtim battle with Israel, the men of Israel fled before, he's supposed to destroy Amalek, and he doesn't. And therefore, we have a recounting of the episode that you studied previously. Shaul was weakened, he was shot by archers, he says to his arms bearer, "Draw your sword and stab me with it, lest these uncircumcised people come and make sport of me. Lest I be captured as the Jewish king paraded through the streets." You think our enemies, this is nothing new, unfortunately. "But lest I, as the Jewish king, be captured and paraded through the streets, he tells his assistant, "I want you to kill me." But the arms bearer could not do it. He was very frightened. So Shaul took the sword, put it in the ground, and fell on top of his own sword, essentially committing suicide. So by the way, the topic of suicide in Jewish law, which is a short topic, in theory, it's forbidden. One should not do it. But it becomes a longer topic when you think about the Jews of Masada, when you think about Jews during the Crusades. When do we kill ourselves rather than fall into enemy hands? So that topic, of course, begins with the analysis of King Shaul and what he did. When he saw Shaul was dying, he too fell on the sword and died. So Shaul and his three sons died, the entire household died together. The people in the valley saw and they fled, they ran back, they told King David, he cried. Shaul and David had a very, if you study in the book of Shmuel, they had a very tense relationship. Now, Shaul was not just David's predecessor, but he was also his father-in-law. King David married Michal, who was the daughter of King Shaul. But when, once King Shaul realized he was losing the throne and it was going to David, he spent his life in pursuit of David, trying to kill him. So here David is avoiding his father-in-law who's trying to kill him. His best friend in the entire world is Yonasan, who is Shaul's son, his brother-in-law also. Anyway, fascinating family dynamics going on there. So that's chapter 10. Chapter 10 is King Shaul. King Shaul gets a whopping one chapter. Now, chapter 11 through 29. 18 chapters dedicated to the reign of David HaMelech. So again, there's tremendous parallels. If you study Divrei HaYamim, you can contrast it to the way the same stories appear in the books of Shmuel and Malachim. By the way, does that remind you of any other book in Tanakh? Another book in Tanakh which seems to be a summary of the books that precede it and that we use to contrast to study the way the episodes are recording in it versus other books? Devarim. Excellent. The book of Devarim. The book of Devarim, the fifth and final book of the five books of Moshe, of the Torah itself. Devarim is Moshe's soliloquy before he's going to die and the Jewish people are going to enter the land. And in that long monologue, Moshe recounts so much of Jewish history. And we use Devarim, which is a summary, to contrast the way the episodes are recorded there versus earlier. Divrei HaYamim, even that name itself is reminiscent. Divrei HaYamim, Devarim, right? Not only if you say it quickly, but if you just take out the middle letters, Divrei HaYamim is Devarim. It is what Devarim is to the first four books, to Chumash. Divrei HaYamim is to the rest of Tanakh. So if you were to look at, we don't have the time obviously, but if you study chapters 11 through 29, you would enjoy contrasting the way the episodes of David's life are recorded in Divrei HaYamim versus the way they were recorded in the book of Shmuel. Then, now we get to Divrei HaYamim Beis, book 2. Chapters 1 through 9 deal with the reign of King Shlomo, of Shlomo HaMelech. And then the last 26 chapters of Divrei HaYamim are the kingdom of Yehuda from Rehavam until the end. Rehavam, the king of Shlomo, remember I mentioned, he continued to tax the people, they broke away, he had a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. That's how you divide the book. So the book can be divided into those five sections. Genealogical tables, the reign of Shaul, one chapter, the reign of David, 18 chapters, the reign of Shlomo, 9 chapters, and then when the kingdom splits, only emphasis on the southern kingdom. Remember, we don't track the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Yehuda from Rehavam until the end. That's how this book lays itself out. So the structure of Divrei HaYamim essentially reveals the story of an unbroken chain from Adam, from the very creation of man, to the return from the exile. It is essentially a family tree, a lineage, a line from the creation of man, person after person after person, all the way until the return from the first exile and the building of the second Beis HaMikdash. So the first message that I want to share with you, the first understanding of what Divrei HaYamim is about, is essentially It is a testimonial to the authenticity of King David and his line. It is a testimonial to the destiny of the Jewish people, essentially. Who says we're entitled to be here? What is our destiny? What is our future? How did we get here? You know, the famous statement that you can't know where you're going if you don't know where you come from. So Divrei HaYamim, as Tanakh kind of sends us on our way for the rest of Jewish history, it reminds us in a summary fashion where we came from Adam until the end. But it does so very selectively. It does so using a filter. It does so only by including those people, those entities, which will reinforce and which will testify to the authenticity of our existence. So, Adam, we get almost immediately to Avraham, because we don't really care about that which comes between. It's about Adam getting to Avraham. And after Avraham, we don't really care about Yishmael and his descendants, because our existence, the authenticity for which we are here, travels through Yitzchak. Esav and his descendants, we don't really care. It's Yishmael. I'm sorry, it's, God forbid, it's Yaakov, it's Yisrael. His 12 children, do we care about the other 11 children? Absolutely. But we don't emphasize them. Who do we emphasize first in Divrei HaYamim? Yehuda. Why? Because Yehuda is monarchy. Yehuda is royalty. Yehuda is the progenitor of King David, and that's what we care about, is getting to this line of our survival, of our right towards sovereignty, of leadership, and even more we'll mention in a moment. So we care about Yehuda because it gets us all the way to King David. From King David we keep going and we get all the way to Rehoboam. But then there's a split, Rehoboam to the south, Judah, Yeravam takes 10 tribes to the north, Israel. Do we care about the northern kingdom? No, they're not part of the destiny of the Jewish people. What happened to those 10 tribes? They became lost. That's why they're called the lost 10 tribes. We don't care about the northern kingdom. There's no emphasis. From the southern kingdom, from Yehuda, we get all the way down to Ezra, to the return, return from the exile, the year 586. Was the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. 70 years later, in the year 516 BCE, we come back, and that's how the book ends. It traces the unbroken line. So we have a family tree, but where it becomes a dotted line, we don't care about. We are tracking and tracing our history through the unbroken line, all the way from Adam, through Noach, through Avraham, until we get to King David and beyond the southern kingdom. Because what is it essentially helping us anticipate? What is it helping us realize? Who will ultimately as well descend from King David with a similar unbroken line? What's the next chapter of Tanakh? Mashiach. It's essentially setting the stage for what is the unwritten chapter of Tanakh, which is Mashiach, who will descend from King David. So all of Divrei HaYamim, all of Chronicles, is essentially chronicling the history of King David, the authenticity of his lineage and of his line, the anticipation of the continuity of that line that will ultimately be realized with Mashiach, with the Messiah. So it's a very selective recounting of Jewish history. It's not a summary of Tanakh thematically, because if it was a summary of Tanakh thematically using themes, what should I have found? Har Sinai, the giving of the Torah. What should I have found? Entering the land. What should I have found? The northern kingdom and other major events of Jewish history. But Divrei HaYamim does not concern itself with major events of history. Divrei HaYamim presents history not through events and not through episodes, but rather through people. It is a recounting of history presented through people. In other words, I could present you with a book of my family history which tells the story, or I could show you a family tree that can track my descendants all the way down to me. And the existence of those people, the history is told through the people. Divrei HaYamim is a history of, it's a summary of Tanakh, it's a history of the Jewish people from Adam through Noach, through Avram and so on, but told through people and through lineage rather than through places, events, and through story. Okay, so all of that is number one. All of that is number one, what Divrei HaYamim is all about, what is its theme, What is it trying to communicate to us? The Greek title of Divrei Hayamim is, I'm going to try to pronounce this. You have it on your hand there? Yeah, the third bullet. Greek title. How do you pronounce that? Paralepomena. Who's Greek here? It's all Greek to me. I have no idea how to pronounce it. But that Greek word apparently means things omitted. The Greek word means the things omitted. Missing bits from earlier books. See, the Greeks misunderstood. Right? The Septuagint. That Divrei Hayamim is trying to fill in the blanks. We end Tanakh with a book that's trying to fill in the blanks from earlier books. But that's not what it's about, because it's not really filling in blanks. In fact, it leaves many blanks itself, because it's really this other theme that we mentioned about. It's essentially reframing the entire Tanakh. It's reframing all of Tanakh to be able to see through a lineage. Just as Dvarim reframed the first four books. There are a lot of parallels between Divrei Hayamim and Dvarim. Divrei Hayamim is to Tanakh what Dvarim is to the first four books. That name is kind of a funny name. Divrei Hayamim, the words of the days, the things of the days. Divrei things, Yamim of time, days of our lives. Divrei Hayamim. But if you see Divrei Hayamim as a play on the word Dvarim, then it makes a little bit more sense. Okay, all of that was number one. Should we take a break? Keep on going. Keep on going. No break necessary. Okay. Now, there's four major themes that come out through Divrei Hayamim, and that's what I want to spend time with you. If you look on your handouts, you'll see there are 2, 3, 4, and 5. Genealogies, the temple and God, kinship and continuity, and studying history. Okay? So we start with genealogies. Divrei, by the way, just as one other word of introduction, there are major sections of our davening that come from Divrei Hayamim. For example,
the paragraph that we say after Baruch She'amar,
Hodu Lashem Kiru Bishmo, Hodu Bamim Alilosav, open up to Divrei Hayamim 1, chapter 16. Divrei Hayamim 1, chapter 16, verse 8. And you will recognize, what's the context of this? This is in the context of King David, right? I'm telling the story of King David. It's chapter 15, 16, the reign of King David. King David, the ark arrives. He is welcoming the ark, the Aron, that contains the tablets, the Luchos, to the city of David. Celebration and thanksgiving. And in the context of that celebration of welcoming the ark, you remember what happens, by the way? He dances in the street. And has been happening since throughout all of Jewish history. What happens? His Jewish wife criticizes him. I was supposed to invoke a little laughter. Vayi Aron Bris Hashem, the end of chapter 15. As the Ark of Hashem arrived in the city of David, by the way, if you haven't visited the city of David, to the south of the old city, the excavations there are incredible. Michal, daughter of Shaul, peered out the window, saw King David dancing and cavorting before Hashem, and she became contemptuous of him in her heart. David HaMelech was so free-spirited. He was unencumbered by a physical body weighing him down. He was just a free spirit at that moment, so overwhelmed with joy, dancing in the street. To his wife, he looked like a drunken sailor. She grew such contempt of him, and that didn't bode well for their relationship and marriage. But King David is overwhelmed with this emotion. And what does he say when he's overwhelmed with this emotion? See if you recognize verse 8. Divrei Hayamim 1, chapter 16, verse 8. Hodu Lashem Kiru Bishma, Hodu Bamim Al Losav, Shilo Zamrlo, Sichu Bechonif Losav, Hisalu B'Shem Kacho. This whole paragraph, we say it every single day in davening. 7 days a week, 365 days a year. This is the paragraph we say after Baruch She'amar. It comes from Divrei Hayamim. Another major part of davening that comes from Divrei Hayamim, there are a few, but just to bring another one to your attention, is, see if you recognize, Divrei Hayamim 1, chapter 29. Divrei Hayamim 1, chapter 29, verse 10. See if you recognize it. Chapter 29, verse 10. What's the context of this, by the way? David HaMelech's last blessing. He's dying. He's on his deathbed. He's weak. You remember the whole story where he's cold in his bed. He needs to be warmed up. He asks for a young lady to be brought to him. Okay, no comment on that. We'll study that another time. But anyway, this is his final charge to the Jewish people. And what does he say to them? The very end of his life? Vayivarach David es Hashem leinei kol hakahal vayomer David baruch ata Hashem Elokei Yisrael avinu me'olam ve'ad olam lecha Hashem hagedula v'hagvura v'hativeres v'hanetzav ve'od. You recognize this from davening? This we say how many times a week? Every single day. 365 days a year. Weekdays, Shabbos, Yantif. Vayivarach David es Hashem leinei kol hakahal. We stand for this. We stand when we say this. You know why we stand when we say this? Right, it appears in the Siddur. Baruch Hashem li'olam amein v'amein. And then Vayivarach David es Hashem. Right before Az Yashir and Yishtabach. We have the custom of standing for Vayivarach David. You know why? Very interesting. Because when there's another custom that when you say the words from Divrei Hayamim, these words in Vayivarach David, verse 12, V'ha'usher v'ha'kavod milfanecha v'yata moshel bakol v'yadcha koch u'gvura. Yours, Hashem, wealth and honor come from you, and you rule everything in your hand is power and strength. It's in your hand to make anyone great or strong. You know what the custom to do is when you say those words? Ha'usher v'ha'kavod milfanecha. Wealth and honor come from you. The custom is to give tzedakah at that moment. So you'll notice if you're in shul in the morning that people go to the tzedakah box and they give tzedakah, they give charity, when saying those words, that wealth and honor, God, come from you. So why do we stand? So it's quoted by the Mishnah Berurah, we stand to honor those who are giving tzedakah. So our standing really has nothing to do with the words themselves, Vayivarach David. Our standing is to honor those who are giving tzedakah, who are fulfilling the custom of giving charity at the moment that we say, wealth and honor, God, come from you. Very powerful, by the way, worth studying this another time, that King David's on his deathbed, and he doesn't krechts and moin and ay me, my life miserable, my hip, my knee, my this, my back, everything hurts. What does he do on his deathbed? God, you're the greatest, you're unbelievable, all good comes from you, you've been remarkably good to me. This last charge he gives the Jewish people at the end of his life is incredible. It's kind of his last will and testament, and this is what we read every single day as part of davening, Vayivarach David. By the way, which also makes sense, because most of the davening comes from, we studied Tehillim together. And most of our davening is taken from the book of Tehillim Psalms. Who wrote Tehillim? David. So even when we go to Divrei Hayamim, we leave Psalms and go to Divrei Hayamim, but whose words are we still reading? King David. He is the great poet who formulated all of our words that we'd be able to say. So I just wanted to share a few examples of major parts of our davening that come from Divrei Hayamim. So as obscure as this text is, as much as it's neglected, as little as it's studied, there are still major portions of it that come from, major portions of it that enter our prayers. Area number one, genealogy. Genealogy. So perhaps what Divrei Hayamim is trying to communicate is our history, as we mentioned, through a family tree, because we are a nation that is built on families. We are a nation built on an expanding family tree. Right? That it's a reminder that we're not just a nation that happens to be a conglomeration of private individuals, but we're a family. We're a family. We studied this. When I did Bereishis Shmos Vayikra Bamidbar Tvarim in one class, if you remember, first opening class of Tanakh, and we talked about how Bereishis is the story of the evolution of a family. Bereishis is the story of a family that can't get it right, brothers keep arguing, parents not getting along, major problems in the book of Bereishis, and it ends with the finally understanding the family unit. To Shmos, where the family unit comes down to Egypt, the family expands, and they become a people. And they leave Egypt and they become a nation. And they become a nation now with a mission. And so on and so forth. The Jewish people are an incredibly lucky and fortunate people. Because here's something that we have that no one else has. If you live in America and you're a proud, proud, proud American, as I believe we should be, you're patriotic. So on the one hand, you feel very connected and very patriotic with fellow Americans. But do we have a family connection? A biological connection? No. We're not family. We're family in the sense that we're all from America, proud to be Americans. But we're not family. If you live in China, maybe you're patriotic, you're proud to be Chinese, but you're not necessarily related to every Chinese person. With every other country, with every other... If you're proud of your ethnicity, if you're proud of your race, if you're African American, if you're... You connect, you identify with a group of people, but you're a group of people who happen to have something in common that binds you. Either it's your race, or it's your country that you're of origin, it binds you together. Jewish people have something else which is very special. We are one family. We are a large and growing family. We're a family that welcomes new family members in. You could convert and join the Jewish people. We welcome in new family members. You know, convert, it's like the equivalent of in-laws. Someone can marry into the family and then they become part of the family. It's still not just being another American. They're part of the family. A convert marries into the family and is now a full-fledged, absolute card-carrying member of the family. But it's a very, very powerful message, a very powerful statement. The Jewish people are not simply a conglomeration of private individuals who happen to have something in common. We all come from the same country. We all have the same color skin. We are actually, we can trace ourselves back to one nuclear family, and we have emerged as an expansion of this family. We are family. And that's why when you're in some exotic location, and you don't expect to see a Jew, and you see someone else who's Jewish, and you meet someone else who's Jewish, you overhear them speaking Hebrew, you see a yarmulke, you wink at each other, you connect and you realize you're Jewish, you immediately feel a kinship. You immediately feel connected. Why? When you're somewhere, if you're in France and you hear someone speak English, do you feel connected because there's another American? Maybe. It's another American. Cool. Another American. Are you drawn to them the way you are when you see another Jew? Because that other Jew is a member of the family. That's your cousin. And if you talk long enough, you'll figure out that you probably somehow are cousins. And so the Jewish people are not just a nation, we're not just a race, we're not even just a people, we're a family. And Divrei HaYamim, to a certain extent, is trying to communicate that message. Because as it recounts our history, and as it propels us towards our destiny, it's trying to remind us that we are a family. And the best way to communicate that you're a family is to be presented with a family tree. When you see that family tree and you see your name next to that other person's name and you see the branches that are going up and traced towards the same roots, now you feel you're part of a family. So Divrei HaYamim is communicating. That's the first theme, genealogy. That we are not just a ethnicity, religion, nation, race, people, but we are a family. Now, how would you briefly tell the story of the Jewish people? In Divrei HaYamim, it's told not through narratives and storylines, but it's told through names. By mentioning certain names right away, it evokes memories, it evokes nostalgia, it evokes certain thoughts. Very few actual events mentioned in Divrei HaYamim. What we mention is people. They are all links in a chain. Divrei HaYamim is emphasizing the concept of chain. Somebody's ready to intermarry, God forbid, someone we know is dating a non-Jew, show them Divrei HaYamim. Say, are you prepared to break this chain? Look at the way it goes all the way back to Adam, to Adam. You are a link in this chain. The next chapters of Divrei HaYamim of Tanakh include your name. You're part of this family tree, which is so large you can't even imagine it. Are you prepared to break that chain? Are you prepared to break that link? That's what Divrei HaYamim is. It testifies to the lineage, to the family, to the names of the Jewish people. And ultimately, this is what we call Yichus. We use that term Yichus. What's Yichus? Yichus is a connection. Yichus is family background. Yichus, the best translation, is probably pedigree. What is your pedigree? Who do you come from? Who are your parents and grandparents? What's your Yichus? Yichus means, you know who my parents were. You could have good yichus, you could have bad yichus. You know, if your father is Madoff, you have pretty bad yichus right now. If your father is, if your grandfather was Rav Moshe Feinstein, you have great yichus. Yichus is an important value. Now, yichus is not everything. Even more important a value than having yichus is what we like to call creating yichus. Because we forget. We think of yichus only as being from what comes before us. But we forget we are the yichus of what comes after us. Will people talk about our children? Oh, they've got great yichus. That mother, that father are amazing. We create the yichus for the next generation. So yichus is an important concept, not only in terms of where we descend from, but in terms of our obligation to our descendants in creating yichus. Now you might think that term yichus is a new term, a modern term in dating, but that term yichus is an old term. And in fact, where does that term yichus appear more than anywhere else in the entire Tanakh? Excellent. Divrei HaYamim. And Divrei HaYamim in our book of Chronicles. I'll give you two examples. Look in book 1, chapter 5, verse 1. Book 1, chapter 5, verse 1. Uvnei Reuven b'chor Yisrael ki hu b'chor v'chalalo yitzuei aviv nitna b'chor asol uvnei Yosef ben Yisrael v'lo hisyaches la b'chora. The sons of Reuven, the firstborn of Israel, he was the firstborn, but when he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, son of Israel, although not to receive the hereditary right of the firstborn. So what's the term yichus being used for there? To say that Reuven ruined his yichus. Why? Remember that episode? Who's Reuven's mother? Leah. And he sees Yaakov, his father Yaakov, is going into the tent with Rachel. And he says, it's my mother's turn, it's my mother's night for your companionship. Right? And he prepares the Dudaim, you remember? Yes. The whole story? So, and because of that, he challenged his father, he embarrassed his father, he undermined his father. So here the verse in Divrei HaYamim is recounting that Reuven, look at this powerful word, lo hisyaches labchora. He, even though he was the firstborn, he lost the rights of the firstborn because of that. And they went instead to Yosef, to Joseph. So says the verse, lo hisyaches labchora. He lost his yichus to the bechora, to the firstborn. So you see this term, yichus. Another example is chapter 9, verse 1. Chapter 9, verse 1. V'chol Yisrael hisyachsu. All of the Jewish people, this is the returning exiles now, all of the Jewish people registered their genealogies. In other words, all of the Jewish people recorded their yichus. Yichus is a very powerful and important concept. Not that it can replace our own merits. Yichus can only get you so far. Yichus can maybe open the door, but you have to still earn walking through it or staying there. So you have Reuven lost the birthright, he lost his yichus. A summary of the book so far is described as an issue of the Jewish people recorded their yichus. So yichus is ancestry, lineage, good family, genealogy, all these different words, the words that we use today. The word yichus is actually mentioned 15 times in Divrei HaYamim. It's used more times in Divrei HaYamim than the rest of Tanakh combined. We don't find that term yichus making an appearance in Tanakh in general, and yet in Divrei HaYamim it's used 15 times, which is more than the rest of all of Tanakh combined. What does that tell you the theme of the book of Divrei HaYamim is? Yichus, genealogy, family tree, where you come from and where you're going. So, and all of that is leading not only to reinforce the concept of family, to reinforce the importance of lineage and genealogy, but also the legitimacy of monarchy, the bloodline, the Davidic bloodline, that David descends from a legitimate line, and that Mashiach will as well. Okay? So all of that is number one. So there's so many ways to tell a story. You could tell a story with narration. You could tell a story by naming places. By the way, we find that in the Torah, right? When it describes that we went from here to there and here to there and here to there, and Rashi says it was really a criticism of the people because each of those places they had complained, but Moshe didn't want to speak Lashon Hara, he didn't want to gossip about the people. So rather than explicitly remind them, remember when you did this there and that there and that there, all he said is, remember we traveled from here to there and here to there and here to there, and mentioning the place told the story. So you could tell a story with narrative, you could tell a story by mentioning places, and you could tell a story by talking about people and by talking about lineage, and that's the story of Divrei HaYamim. Yes?
We should be very proud of our lineage and our genealogy, yet Jews are not a proselytizing people. Why are we not a proselytizing people?
That's a great question. It's a little bit too, the answer is a little bit beyond the scope of this. Why are we not a proselytizing people? If we're so proud of where we come from and so proud of what we stand for, let's get on the rooftops, let's stand on the soapbox, let's scream it, let's shout it, let's go recruit converts. Let's grow our people. We're pathetically small after all this time. Let's grow a number, right? Deserves a much longer answer. It's a good question.
There was a time when we were proselytizing stops in about the 10th century. So I was curious to know why it stopped.
I'm not sure that we were ever in actively or aggressively proselytizing people. Okay, we could talk about that, debate that another time. It's a good question. It's worthy of its own its own study for another time. I just want to finish this first section, then we'll take a break and see the next two sections. And we'll actually take a break. What time are we supposed to end?
11.
Oy, gewalt. I thought I had nothing to say on Divrei Hayamim. How am I going to fill the time? Okay, so let's talk about this very quickly. This concept, what Divrei Hayamim essentially then is about, you could use the term peoplehood. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Chief Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, has a book called Future Tense. And in it he talks about this concept of peoplehood. And he makes the following points. Do you know that the first time the word peoplehood appeared in the English dictionary was the year 1992? It's a fairly modern concept, peoplehood, but not for the Jewish people. For the Jewish people, the concept of peoplehood goes way back, and that's what Divrei Hayamim is all about. If you were to type peoplehood right now on your computer, you'd probably, your spell check would tell you that it's not a word. But peoplehood is really a real word. And he writes, quote, "This mix of fate and faith, nationhood and religion, means that from the very beginning Jews have had to live with the tension of these two very different ideas. It is that tension that has made Jews creative, unpredictable, diverse, conflicted, yet somehow more than the sum of their parts. The mix of fate and faith, nationhood and religion. The creation of the world of the word peopledhood might have been an attempt to describe what binds desperate and disconnected Jews across the world. When all else might have forgotten, we are a people." In other words, we don't have a country that binds us. For 2,000 years, we were dispersed across the world. We don't have a language which binds us. For 2,000 years, we spoke different languages. We don't have a culture that binds us. For 2,000 years, we lived among different cultures. So how are we still here? When all of these other empires, nations, and people are part of the past, gone. The Persians, the Byzantines, they're all gone. Here we are, the Jews, dispersed without a place, without a language, without a culture. And the answer is, we had a peoplehood. We were a family. And even when a family becomes dispersed, they never lose their identity as a family. And that's part of what this is all about. It's the notion of an unbroken chain. And as we read Divrei Hayamim, we see ourselves as a link in the continuity of that unbroken chain. Okay, area number two. We'll wrap it up. I'll go through the next three quickly, and that'll be that. Temple and God. So another one of the major themes of Divrei Hayamim is the centrality of the Beis HaMikdash. The centrality of the Beis HaMikdash. And the role of the priesthood. You have this in number three in your handouts. Right? So if you notice, when we were going through the lineages, the genealogies, we started with Judah, and then we went on this little deviation. We talked about the Levium, and the Kohanim, and the musicians, and the singers, and only then the gatekeepers, and only then do we get to the rest of David HaMelech's administration, the officers and the judges, the civil servants, and other important positions. So when it's tracing the lineage, the genealogy, all these people, we have Levium, Kohanim, the musicians, the singers, the gatekeepers of the temple, and only then do we get to his administration, the officers and judges, civil servants, and so on. What message does that communicate? Who's more important? Who plays the dominant role? If Divrei Hayamim is recounting the whole staff, so isn't the order of the staff going to communicate something? If I tell you the order of the staff, maybe hopefully you begin with the rabbi. But if you said rabbi, and then you said administrator, and then you said assistant rabbi, and then you said custodian, and then you said, you're going to go in order, you're trying to communicate. So who comes first? Levium, Kohanim, gatekeepers of the Beis HaMikdash. Clearly, the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, plays a very dominant role. The priests, the Kohanim, play a very dominant role within the Jewish people, within our history, and within our lineage. And that's what Divrei Hayamim is trying to emphasize. So you see that in the order the lineage is given. You see that in another way. In another way, I'm just looking at your handouts. This second one is not mentioned here in the handouts. And that is the use of a particular word. And this is very timely, because this particular word actually was in last week's parsha, this coming week's parsha. So, as always, there's no coincidences. And that is the word ma'al. Ma'al is mem, ayin, lamed. Right? Last week's Torah portion, Vayikra, says, what happens if you're ma'al? If you have consecrated property that was dedicated to the temple, and you use it instead of for a holy purpose, you use it for a private purpose. So you have money, clothing, a chair, wood, something which was dedicated to be used in the temple, and you use it for a private purpose. So that's called ma'al. You can look it up in last week's parsha, in this week's parsha. This word ma'al appears over and over again in Divrei Hayamim. It is the hallmark of divine retribution. The idea of ma'al is to violate God. When, for example, I'll give you a few examples. Divrei Hayamim 1, chapter 2, verse 7. Chapter 2, verse 7 is talking about Acham. Anyone remember Uvnei Karmi? Achar Ucher Yisrael Asher Ma'al Bacherim. Acham. And remember who Achan is? When they conquer Jericho, in the book of Joshua, they were not allowed, they were instructed that they were not allowed to touch the spoils. Do you remember? Don't touch the loot, the booty, don't touch the spoils. Somebody did, and it brought on a plague. And through lottery, they determined who it was, because they needed to be killed, because no one was supposed to, a message needed to be sent to the people. And who did they determine it was? It was Achan. Achan, who had touched the spoils of Jericho. Since Jericho, Jericho was conquered in a miraculous fashion. You remember they walked around it 7 times and the walls crumbled down. Since it was conquered in a miraculous fashion, therefore, that which was conquered was supposed to be dedicated to the temple and not used for private use. Achan used it for private use nonetheless. He was put to death. He actually composed a prayer right before he was put to death. Anyone remember which prayer he composed right before being put to death? The second paragraph of Aleinu. Al-Kain Nekavalacha Hashem Elokeinu. Ya-Kain Nekavalacha. How do you remember that? An acronym. Al-Kain Nekava. First letter spell. Achan. Achan was this character. So here in Divrei Hayamim, when it describes, what did Achan do wrong? Asher ma'al b'cherem. He transgressed the ban. He touched that which wasn't his. He used something sacred for the mundane. You see this in terms of Reuven, Gad, and half of Menasheh, the exile of the Norman kingdom. We don't have time to look at all these psukim. Shaul, when he makes his mistake and it goes bad, he was ma'al. He rebelled against God. Menasheh, the wicked king, rebels against God. All are responsible. So here you see that they all make the same mistake, namely ma'al. It means trespass, treachery, betrayal. Ultimately, every wrong turn is a betrayal of God. So another theme that connects to the temple and God is, just as I can't go into God's temple, take something which was dedicated for His service and use it for the mundane, use it privately, so too, when God lets me use His world, and instead of using it for the sacred, instead of lifting it, uplifting it, I use it for the mundane, I am rebelling. It's an act of betrayal and treachery against God. Okay, number three in terms of our themes is kingship and continuity. Kingship and continuity. So, if you remember, clearly Divrei Hayamim is trying to communicate the concept of monarchy and kingship. Why? Why do I say that? Because again, we omitted the destiny, what happened with the northern kingdom. The 10 lost tribes are not discussed. Their story is not told. Why? Because we don't care about it in Divrei Hayamim. Divrei Hayamim is not a history book. It's not trying to retell the history. We already have that in the book of Malachim and the book of Kings. Instead, Divrei Hayamim is telling the story of the monarchy of Yehuda, of Judah. Why? Because it is the progenitor of King David, who will be the progenitor of Mashiach, of the Messiah, and that's what it is all about. It's about authenticating King David's line, which in turn authenticates the lineage, the line of Mashiach himself. If you contrast for a moment, turn all the way back to the book of Malachim. In the book of Malachim, if you're looking at the art scroll Tanakh, it's Malachim, it's Kings 1, chapter 1. Kings 1, chapter 1. I could just read it to you. If you have an art scroll Tanakh, it's page 796. Ve'amelach David zakein ba bayamim. King David was old, advanced in years. Vayechasu babigadim v'lo yichamlo. They covered him with clothing, but he did not become warm. So what did he do? I was alluding to this earlier. He told the servants, let there be sought for my lord the king a young virgin who will stand before the king and his attendant. She will lie with you and will be warm for the Lord my king. It's a very, very dark, depressing scene. Political. He's lying. He's the king. They're referring to him as my lord, my servant, my king. He's dying. He's cold. He's growing old. It's depressing. In Divrei Hayamim, the same scene is described in a very different way. Divrei Hayamim 1, chapter 29. Divrei Hayamim 1, chapter 29, verse 26. V'David ben Yishai Malach al Kol Yisrael. King David was the king of all of Israel. V'ayamim asher Malach Yisrael arba'im shana. He ruled 40 years. Ben Chevron for 7 years and Jerusalem for 33 years. V'ayamas b'seva tova, seva yamim osher v'chavod. He died in a good old age, sated with years, wealth, and honor. The description of his end, of his demise, is not dark and gloomy and political and cold, and it's described much more majestic, regal, royal. It's a rewriting that clearly asserts the bloodline. Clearly, Divrei Hayamim is trying to reframe David HaMelech, reframe the lineage and the line. It's about kingship and it's about continuity. The end of the book, too, is very neat. We see how Divrei Hayamim is written as an apolitical manifesto. It's not taking political positions, it's not about politics. It is simply justifying the bloodline, authenticating the bloodline, and the next word, which is the bloodline of Mashiach. And that indeed is in fact the very end of Divrei Hayamim. How does Divrei Hayamim end? It's very powerful. We read this to start, but this maybe will end. Divrei Hayamim ends with Koresh offers this proclamation, and what's the proclamation that he offers? I am rebuilding God's temple. Everyone's invited to Jerusalem. V'ya'al! Go up! Go up. Our Tanakh ends on a very positive message. Our Tanakh ends with a very strong and positive charge. Namely, go up. Go up. Go up and go on. We've chronicled our history. We've reminded you that we are a family. We've re-emphasized the concept and the theme of peoplehood. We traced everything where we came from Adam through King David, and we anticipate with great yearning the coming of Mashiach. And now Tanakh ends by saying, the rest is up to you. The Ya'al, go up. You create the rest of history. You forge the rest of Jewish destiny. So congratulations to all of you for completing Tanakh. It's a major, major milestone. You deserve a big mazel tov. Go celebrate today. L'chaim. And have a fantastic day.